All right, we're beginning here on the top of Membet Amud Aleph. Yesterday we left off with the discussions with regards to the sources for shlichut, the ability to appoint an agent, a proxy, to act on your behalf, and that shlucho shel adam kimoto. And we saw that there were different sources for that, and in each instance we asked what was the source, and then we explained why we couldn't extrapolate or learn from that source to the other sources, and that's why we needed all of them. The last thing that we left off with was with regards to the Korban HaPesach by Kodashim. How do we know that Shlichut works by Kodashim? So we had the Shita of Rabbi Yeshua ben Karcha, which is V'shachatu oto kol kahal adat Yisrael ben Arvayim. The fact that you have everybody, quote-unquote, shechting the Korban HaPesach, when we know not everybody shechting the Korban HaPesach. You only have one person from each Chabura, or even possibly a Kohen or a proxy that's shechting for them. And therefore, it's clear that there is an agent or a shliach that's allowed to be used by the Korban HaPesach. Then we question Rabbi Yonatan. Then we moved on to the sheet of Rabbi Yonatan. He says that all works well for Rabbi Yeshua ben Karcha. But for Rabbi Yonatan, who uses that pasuk to teach you something else, which is what we left off with, which is the Tanya, Rabbi Yonatan Omer, Minayin Shekol Yisrael Kulan Yotzim BePesach Echad. How do you know that all of Klal Yisrael could be Yotze with one single Pesach? As Rashi notes up here, it's clear that Rabbi Yonatan believes that you don't need a kazayit worth of Korban HaPesach, otherwise this would be impossible. It says, Shenemar, v'shachatu oto kol kaal adat Yisrael ben Arbayim. V'chi kol ha'kaal kulam shochatim, v'enu shochet el echad. V'mikan shekol Yisrael yotzim b'Pesach echad. We see from this pasuk that everybody can be Yotze with one single Pesach. But that means that that's where he's learning from that pasuk, not the union of shlichut. Shliach v'kodoshim minalei. For Rabbi Yonatan, where does he know, or where does he have the source for shlichut? Mar says, minei, from the same source. We noted this yesterday, that by definition, if you can have one Korban HaPesach for all of Klal Yisrael, then you also have a shliach, because whoever shechs that Korban HaPesach, and whoever takes care of it, is doing it on behalf of all of Klal Yisrael. So there you have shlichut in Kodashim. So despite the fact that he's learning something else from the pasuk, the something else also includes or subsumed in that is the fact that shlichut works by kodoshim. So v'dilma shiny hatam. Where it says maybe that case is different. Deidle shutafut behagavayu, because everybody is a party to the Korban HaPesach, meaning that maybe you can only be a shliach, maybe you can only be an agent or a proxy when you are a party to the item. So over here, if you are a partner in the Korban HaPesach, one of the partners then can act on your behalf. But if you're an independent party completely, can you act as a proxy? Maybe not. We could limit the din of shliach to cases where you are a party to the situation. Ela mehocha. You have to learn it out from here. Vayichulahem ish sele beit avot sele bayit. Because it says by the Korban HaPesach, sele beit avot is said for families, for households, and that there is a sharing of the Korban HaPesach. Gemara again says, V'dilma hatam nami di'idle shutafut v'kavayu. You have the same problem again, which is you are a party to the Korban HaPesach. The fact that you can all join together on a single Korban HaPesach, and one person is going to execute on that Korban HaPesach, shows you there is shlichut. But again, it could be qualified or limited to the situations which you are a party to the item. If you're not a party to the item, maybe you can't have agency, maybe you can't have shlichut. But it says in Cain, Trei Kroi Lamali. Why do you need two psukim to teach you the same thing? You have the pasuk of Eshachatu Oto Kol Kahal Adat Yisrael Ben Arbaim. And you have the psukim of Bichulahem, Ish Selevet Avot Selebayit, that they will take on behalf of these individuals a set for each household, for each family. So you see that you have two psukim teaching you that one person can act on behalf of others. But two psukim teaching you the same din, and both dinim seem to be qualified by the fact that maybe you're a party to the item, then we can say one of them is for that. The other one comes to tell you or use this principle of if it's not for this topic, then we'll extrapolate from it to the other topic, which means it won't be limited anymore to where you're a party to the situation. Now, Tosafot raises the question over here, and we noted it yesterday, which is, according to Rabbi Yeshua ben Karcha, how come you don't have the same problem? Rabbi Yeshua ben Karcha brings a proof from Shachatu Oto Kol Kahal Adat Yisrael, says that one person can shech on behalf of others by the Korban HaPesach. So why don't we say by him also? Why don't we ask the same question? Maybe it's only true when you're a party to the transaction. How come the Gemara only asks this with regards to Rabbi Yonatan's Shita? The answer is because Rabbi Yonatan's Shita is a case where all of Klal Yisrael belong on a single Korban HaPesach, which means that you don't have to have a kezayit for each individual. And the Gzeirat HaKetuvah is that everybody can be joined on this single Korban HaPesach. But that means by definition, everybody is a partner to the Korban HaPesach. And if that's the case, you can ask the question, maybe that being a partner is integral to allowing agency to take place. In other words, Rabbi Shua ben Karcha, there clearly is more than one Korban HaPesach, because everybody has to eat a kezayit. The fact that everybody has to eat a kezayit means by definition you can't use one Korban HaPesach, because there isn't sufficient kezayitim within a single Korban HaPesach to cover everybody that's there. So, therefore, there must be multiple Korbanei HaPesach. Then you look at the pasuk and says, "V'shachadu oto kol ha'kal dat yisrael ben arba'im," that one person's allowed to shech, and over there, that person doesn't necessarily have to be a partner on the Korban HaPesach. Doesn't mean that he is one of the people that is sharing in this particular Korban HaPesach, because there are multiple Korbanei HaPesach here. So if one person shechs all the Korbanot Pesach that are there, he's clearly not a party to all of them. He could be a party to one of them, but not all of them. And therefore, the question is not relevant by Rabbi Shua ben Karcha, but it is relevant by Rabbi Yonatan. So the Gemara says, "Hi, mi baylek the Rabbi Yitzchak." Wait a minute. That's the pasuk. Now you think you have two psukim for Rabbi Yonatan who's going to teach us Veshlichut by Kodashim. That pasuk is already utilized for a different drasha. Dam Rabbi Yitzchak ish zoche, velo katan zoche. A man can be zoche, a katan, a minor, cannot be zoche. That's why it says, v'yichulahem ish, celibate avot, celibate. Ish is defined as a person of age. You see from there that only an ish can be zoche, not a katan. So the first thing is, so Tosfot over here asks, v'im tomar, lama likra, what do I need a pasuk for? V'al kaimalon de'en yad l'katan. We know that a katan doesn't have a yad. He doesn't have the ability to extend himself or to do things. So then why would you even think that the katan could be zoche over here? Yesh lomar, the gabei Pesach, itzrich. Pesach, I need an extra release of the katan. Tzachadat chol b'shayach v'achilat psachim tzrich lihimanot alav. We would think that because he has relevance in the eating of the Pesach, so too he has relevance in including others and being zoche in the Korban HaPesach. So what Tosafot suggests is that this din is a unique din by Korban HaPesach. Then in general, ein yad katan, ein shlichut katan. Why is that not the principle that we're invoking here? Because over here, a katan has a special din. This is sele beit avot, sele bayit. He's a participant in the Korban HaPesach. So maybe his participation also grants him rights with regards to zechiyah and other types of activities that a katan is normally precluded from. That's what the pasuk comes to teach you. Don't say that. That's the way Tosafot deals with it. Other Rishonim go in two different directions and they're opposites. One is that some Rishonim prove from here that Shlichut and Zchiyah are separate worlds and have nothing to do with each other. Because by the fact that the Gemara here says, Ish Zocheh Velo Katan Zocheh, and the Gemara doesn't just say, ein shlichut katan, shows you that zchiyah is working one way, shlichut is working a different way. Otherwise, the Gemara should have brought the principle of, ein shlichut katan. And then they would have solved the problem, or ein yad katan. The fact that they are speaking in terms of zchiyah tells you that zchiyah is a different world than shlichut. Now, we've seen in the Balei Tosafot before that they suggest that shlichut and zchiyah derive from the same place. They are part and parcel of each other. And there are other Rishonim that suggest the same thing over here. So then what do you do with the fact that the Gemara says, V'lo ha-katan zuche, why doesn't it just say, Ein shlichut ha-katan? They basically say, this is the source for the fact that Ein shlichut ha-katan. Why? Because the katan doesn't have zchiyah. He doesn't have zchiyah, then he also doesn't have shlichut. This is the source for that principle, which is found in other places in Shas. And that's why the Gemara doesn't invoke it here or bring it here, because this is where the principle derives from. This is the source of that principle. So again, you have three different ways that we just spoke about to deal with this. One is to say that it's showing that shlichut and zchiya are totally separate, and that's why you need a pasuk to deal with zchiya. The other possibility is zchiya and shlichut are somewhat synonymous, and this is the source for the fact that ain't shlichut to katan. Or you have the Balei HaTosafot suggesting that, yes, this ain't shlichut to katan, but Pesach is an exception because you would have thought the katan's included because of the fact that he has to participate and eat a kazayit min ha-psachim. Tosafot in the Gemara Psachim actually asks, well, if the katan doesn't have a right of zchia on the Korban HaPesach, but he's eating a kazayit from the Korban HaPesach, how does that work? If you're not min ha-minuim, if you're not one of those that is a partner in the Korban HaPesach, you're not allowed to eat from the Korban HaPesach. So in the end, the katan's eating from the Korban HaPesach, but he's not a manui on the Korban HaPesach. He's violating the Easter of eating from a Korban HaPesach that's not yours. Yet, we're saying that he should eat. Tosfot over there comes to a radical conclusion, which is that, l'shem chinuch, you're allowed to violate an Easter d'oraita. And that's what he says, eino chanami. The katan eats a kzai from the Pesach, even though he's not manui on it. And yes, that is a violation of a din d'oraita. Aval mishum chinuch, we allow it. Other rishonim distinguish between the ability of a katan to be zocheh versus a katan's ability to be mizakeh. And that what the Gemara is suggesting over here is not that a katan doesn't have rights of zchia, not that he can't join the Korban HaPesach, but rather he can't be mizakeh acherim. If he has the Korban HaPesach, he can't join other people to the Korban HaPesach. An ish, a person of age, can join other people to his Korban HaPesach. But a katan can't do that. And that might be the distinction between how the katan becomes a participant in the Korban HaPesach versus why does he lose his rights versus the fact that he doesn't have zchia. It might be that he has rights to be a part and join a Korban HaPesach, but he doesn't have rights to join others to his Korban HaPesach, and that might be the distinction here. Umar says, how mi'ish lefiach lo nafko. Mar says, you don't learn that from Ish Selebeit Avot Selebeit, which would have taken away that pasuk for Rabbi Yonatan, but you rather you learn it out, Mish Lefiach Lo Nafka, that there also mentions Ish. And so then that'll be Ish Zoche Vein Katan Zoche. Mar says, V'akata Mi Bailei, we still need that pasuk for another limud. The Shochatin at the Pesach Al Yachid, that if one individual is a big eater, he's going to have his own Korban HaPesach, or a small animal, is he allowed to only party to this Korban HaPesach, a chabura. By definition, do you need a chabura? Because we're not shochet the Pesach al yachid. We need ish lepiach lo to teach you that an individual can be a single individual in a chabura at the Pesach, and therefore it's not available to teach you the din of ish velo katan. If that's the case, the meyuchalem ish se lebeit avot se lebayit is not available for shlichut. It says savalak mandamar ish shochetin at Pesach al yachid. He holds like Rabbi Yehuda, who says that you can't shech the Pesach on an individual chabura, I mean an individual who is the chabura. So Rabbi Yehuda in the Gemara and Psachim is of the opinion that one may not be a yachid, can't have a chabura, one or can't be. He learns it from the pasuk which says, "Lo tuchol isboach et haPesach." The way the pasuk reads is bechad she'arecha. You're not allowed to be mizoveach the Pesach in one of your gateways. He reparses the pasuk to read, "Lo tuchol isboach et haPesach bechad." You're not allowed to have a Pesach with one individual. So that's his limud. It says that you can't have a chabura of one that joins the Korban HaPesach. Wait a minute. We have this memra of Rav Gidol Marav who says, how do we know that agency works? How do we know that a proxy, as if you yourself did it? Shenamar, nasi echad, mimateh. Because it says at the end of Bamidbar, when it comes to Chalukat Haaretz, the division of the land, that each Shevet had a representative in the dividing of the land. And in that division of the land, you have somebody acting on behalf of the inheritors or the parties who are going to get the land. So typically, Shlichut Me'ocha. Why don't we learn out Shlichut from there? Now the question can be one of two. One question could be is, why do we have all the Psukim before that teaches about Shliach Shadam Kimoto? Why don't they just learn from this pasuk that Shliach Adam Kamoto? Or the question could be Amar Rav Gidol Marav, which is, why does Rav Gidol Marav bring it from here? We had all these other sources before. What is he bringing it from Nesi Echad? In all likelihood, we're talking about an Asmachta here, because as Tosafot points out, that this division of the land wasn't exactly your classic division of the land. We're talking about here with the Kohen, the Urim V'Tumim, Hashem's involved, meaning that this wasn't just a division where we're talking about a transactional division. We're talking about a division that has Ruach HaKodesh associated with God's input in this, and therefore the division here is not a typical division, and therefore you would say this is an asmachta, not a direct limud. Others suggest that it depends. When it comes to the broader division of the land, which is which shevet gets which region, that was done on Yidei Urim V'Tumim, and that was done with Moshe and the Aaron, and so on and so forth. But once the Shvatim got to their plots of land, which family or which person gets which plot of land within the Shevet's region, that is a division that was done by the Nesi'im, and it wasn't necessarily done by the Urim V'Tumim. And therefore, you could learn from this, not just an Esmachta, but you could be, this is a proof of Shlucho Shel Adam Kimoto. Where it says, V'Tizbra, Da Shlichutu, does it make sense that we're talking about agency over here? Vaktanim labnei shlichut ninu. Tanim can't have agents work on their behalf, which is, again, what we said before, why the Rishonim are questioning, why didn't the Gemara bring that before? Forget about the Zechiah issue by the Katan. Elik yad rava bar ravuna. Dam rava bar ravuna, amarav, gidol amarav, minayin shizachin adam shalo bifanav. How do we know that you can act on behalf of another person, even if they're not there? Shinemar, v'nasiachat, nasiachat. The Gemara says, no, this is not a proof. This is not a source for Shlucho Shel Adam Kemoto. Rather, this is a proof for the fact that Zechiah works. When somebody does something to your benefit, then they can do it on your behalf or act on your behalf. And so therefore, here, Zechiah, the reason that it works over here by the Nesi'im is not because they are your Shliach, but simply they're doing something to your benefit. They're acquiring land on your behalf. So that's Zechiah. Where it says, V'tizbra schuti? How do you know that it's a merit? Ha-chova nami, Ika. So where it says, wait a minute, this is not all good. There's some bad here. So it's one thing if a person's a shliach, an agent. Then when an agent acts, it doesn't matter if the agent's acting for the good or the bad, as long as he was empowered by the individual to do this. You could argue, and we'll see this on the second half of the daf, that sometimes the sender can claim, I sent you to do something good for me, not something bad for me, and therefore the agency is disengaged because you did the wrong thing or you acted inappropriately. But if they acted within the powers that they are invested with, and they did the best that they could, then the principal is bound by the actions of the agent. On the other hand, if you're talking about zchiyah, that it's done through the fact that someone is acquiring something to your benefit, and since it's to your benefit, anansade, that you would like this, and you would appreciate this, and therefore you're koneh, that's only true if it's positive. But what happens if it's negative? And that's always the possibility. Some people want to live on the top of a mountain, not in the valley. Some people want to live in the valley, but don't want to live up the hill. So if that's the case, when the land was picked, who says everybody was happy with what they got? Who says that they're happy with their lot? So their lot in life. So then, how could you say the principle being learned here is zchiyah? Because zchiyah all is based totally on positive outcomes and not any negative outcomes. Elik the Rav Bar Ravuna, Dam Rav Bar Ravuna, Amar Rav Gidol, Amar Rav. So here you have three memrotes from Rav Bar Ravuna, Amar Rav Gidol, Amar Rav. And now the Gemara is going through each one of them and suggesting, oh, this is the source, this is the source, this is the source. Seemingly, they were all said together, and now the Gemara is trying to determine where the source is, or which one's connected to this, Nasiachat. How we know that orphans who come to subdivide the estate of their father, that Beitin appoints an executor on their behalf, to act on their behalf, whether for good or for bad. L'chov, amai. Why do you need to appoint someone to do something to their detriment? I mean, that why would you ever appoint an executor that does something negative or bad for them? The answer is that they do something that's negative now, but long-term has positive effects. Or maybe the other way around, something that seemingly is positive now, but has negative ramifications. So here, that's what we learn from the pasuk. The nasiachad teaches us that you can have representation. Once Beitin appoints someone to be your representative, then you are bound by that representative, whether it's good or bad. As long as they live up to their fiduciary duty, and that they don't do anything that is obviously negligent, then whatever they do is binding because Beit Din appointed them on behalf of the Yitomim. And that we learn out from Nasi Echad, Nasi Echad. And over here, by Nasi Echad, we already agreed that we're talking about Zchut and Chova. And number two is we're dealing with Ktanim also, who are going to be inheritors of the land. And you see that Beit Din's appointed proxy works for these Ktanim, and works on behalf of these Ktanim, despite the fact that they are Ktanim. And that's why here, Yitomim Shebaol Lachlok, that we say that it works, and the proof is from Nasi Echad, Nasi Echad. Now, there are a number of items to clarify over here. We're going to see it again in the next section of the Gemara, which says that Yitomim Shebaol Lachlok. That's the beginning of the next line in the Gemara as well. And ours also, what we just read, said, Menayin Yitomim Shebaol Lachlok. Yitomim who come to divide. So now, what does that mean that they come to divide? That means that they are voluntarily opting in to dividing. It's not like we're compelling them to divide. They decided that they want to subdivide it. That ends up... Now, the question is, why do they have to voluntarily come in? And what is exactly the scenario over here? You can see there's a little aleph in the grah in the next sugya we're about to read. And he says, Perish Rambam, Shayu Yitomim Dolim Viktanim. That here we had some Yitomim of age and some minors. Rotsim HaGdolim Lachlok. And the ones who are of age want to subdivide the property. They want to get their piece of the estate so they can move forward in life. Problem is that they have brothers who are underage, who are minors. And so then they can't divide the property between them because you can't have a negotiation between the kids who are of age and the minors. So then, Shebaol Lachlok, if they came to subdivide it, Beit Din appoints a apotropos for the Ktanim because we want to help out the Gdolim. So now we need to give representation to the Ktanim. That's what it means, Shebaol Lachlok. They're coming to divide it because there are Gdolim insisting on the division. But if they don't insist on the division, we're not going to appoint an executor to the estate. Or, maybe in the alternate, Shebaol Lachlok is, if the Yitomim are all Ktanim, maybe we would not appoint an apotropos and maybe we would not let them divide the land. Other Rishonim suggest all these different possibilities. The Rambam, you see here, clearly believes that only when Gdolim are involved do we appoint executors to work with the Ktanim, seemingly implying that if it was just Ktanim, we wouldn't do anything of the sort and we wouldn't divide it. Other Rishonim believe that the case here is a case of all Ktanim. Since they're all Ktanim, only if they voluntarily want to divide the property will we acquiesce to their request, despite the fact that there's no reason to do it because they are Ktanim now. Nevertheless, we might do it in a scenario or a situation in which there is a benefit. For instance, they're not all from the same mother. Or there are obligations outstanding on one of them. So we need to deal with those obligations. Then maybe Beit Din wouldn't do it. Other Rishonim suggest that when you have Ktanim here, we would never let you subdivide it. We won't let you make that division because there's no necessity to cause a subdivision. And therefore, it's only when there are Gdolim involved. So here you have, again, different views within the Rishonim as to what the extent of what is going on here. Is it only in the case where there are Gdolim involved that we allow you to subdivide it? Or is it even when Ktanim come in and want to subdivide it, we allow you to do it? Or do we only allow the subdivision by Ktanim when there's a compelling reason to do it? But if there's no compelling reason to do it, we won't do it. So Rishonim come out in all different ways, but it comes out of the language of this Braita, which is Shebaol Lachlok, that they want to divide it. Since they want to divide it, it clearly indicates that there was some sort of request made of the Beit Din. And now the question is, whose request was it that was made? Number two is, we actually had this Gemara in Gittin. And there the Gemara in Gittin says, if you appoint an apotropos for Yitomim, and then he acts on behalf of the Yitomim, he's only allowed to act b'zchut. If he has b'zchut, that ends up as a chov, or a chov that ends up as b'zchut, but tell, his actions are meaningless. So Tosfot raises that right away. He says, v'kasha, damar perikan izakin te'ein apotropos v'shayim l'chov v'l'zchut b'nechsei Yitomim. He doesn't have a right to do something to the detriment of the Yitomim. So now you have two Gemaras coming to the exact opposite conclusion. Gemara Gittin says that the executor has no rights when he does something to the detriment of the Yitomim. And over here, the Gemara is saying, executor, whatever he does is done. No change in good or bad, whatever is done is done. So how do you reconcile between these two Gemarot? Tosva gives different answers. One is, Tahata Mayri B'tviyat Chovot Shesh Lacherim Aleihem. Over there, we're talking about where other people have obligations and are trying to make a claim against the estate. And the apotropos goes to court to defend the Yitomim. and then he loses. Over there, Bahaba, they ain't Rashaim. They have no permission to go to court. Because maybe if we waited around till they came of age, then the claimants against the estate wouldn't make a claim. It'd be too long, they would forget about it, they wouldn't be bothered. So by defending them and going to court now, you caused the loss to the Yitomim. And in that case, we're going to say, you violated your fiduciary duty to the Yitomim, and you'll have to return it, or we won't allow that to go through. Whereas in this case, what Tosfos suggests is that the Yitomim are making a claim against someone else. In that case, we want it to go through, and if he loses the case, he loses the case, but at least he's trying to get more for the Yitomim, not less for the Yitomim. That's one possibility of how to answer it. The other answer to the question might be, who appointed the apitropos? Was the apitropos appointed by Beit Din? And that's the type of apitropos or executor that has powers, whether he does good or bad, because he's been empowered by Beit Din. The other hand, an apitropos, an executor that was appointed by the father before he passed away, that executor only can act for the benefit of the Yitomim, not for the detriment of the Yitomim. So those are different ways to explain the difference between the conclusion of the Gemara here and the conclusion of the Gemara there. Now we continue in the Gemara of Nachman and Shmuel. Yitomim shebaul lachlok b'nechse avihem. Yitomim that come to subdivide the property or the estate of their father. Beitin mamidin lahem apitropos. Beitin appoints for them an apitropos. So here again, the Gemara points out for the Rambam, it means for the ketanim who are involved in this subdivision. Uburin lahem chelek yafet. And they pick a good piece for them. Vim gigdilu yacholim limchot. And when they get older, they can reject that which was done for them. Rav Nachman Didei Amar, that was Rav Nachman, the name of his Rebbe Shmuel. Rav Nachman himself says, Amar, im yigdilu einam yacholim limchot. When they grow up, you can't reject it. Dim kei makoach beitin yofet. Then what was the whole point of appointing an executor along the way if it can be unwound in the back end? You basically undermine the whole institution of Beit Din and the appointment of an executor because it's meaningless. He can back out of it in the end, then you're just lucky if he wants it. If he doesn't want it, they're just going to erase everything that was done. So that is the position of Rav Nachman. Right? Two things to note over here. One, it says that you appoint an apitropos uborim lahem. Now, when you appoint them an apitropos, does that mean that you appoint one apitropos to represent all the ketanim? Or is it in a case where you appoint one apitropos for every katan? Does every katan get his own executor, own representative? Now, part of that might deal with what we said before. If you're talking about gedolim that are asking for the subdivision of the estate, and the katanim are involved, there, in all likelihood, we would assume that there's an apitropos for every katan, because we need someone to represent the rights of each party, or the interests of each party independently. On the other hand, if you believe it's all katanim, it's possible that you could argue that one apitropos could do it for all of them. Because when they're all ketanim, there's nobody making an argument on their own behalf. Simply, the apitropos is trying to come to a equitable division of the estate. He doesn't have any favoring of one party over the other. He's simply trying to act to subdivide it amongst children. And therefore, maybe there you could argue that you only need one apitropos for all the ketanim. So it might be influenced by what the case is, or you could argue that it's independent. Either we're going to always have representation for each kid, or that one can represent all of them. So now, that's one issue. Next thing is, uborim lahem chelek yafeh. You choose for them a good piece. What does that mean, you choose for them a good piece? So if you look at Tosfot, the Ri comes to the conclusion from this. Lashon borim hayam intaktig Ri, dainu below goral. That means that they do without throwing lots. D'mad breira shayach b'goral. Choose for them a good piece means that you're actively engaged in the negotiation. But if you say that you just throw lots, and whoever's lot comes out, that's the land that you get, then why are you saying borim? You're not choosing. You're simply watching over, making sure that it's a fair and equitable lottery that's being done. That you don't need a lottery to determine. You do not need an assessment by Beit Din. All the division has to do with what he thinks or what he thinks is best. Because the proxy or the agent here is basically replacing the Yitomim because they are not old enough to do this. But if that's the case, he basically is representing them as if they were Gedolim. And if they were Gedolim, then they would work it out between them. They wouldn't have to go to Beit Din to get the land divided. They wouldn't have to go to Beit Din to get it assessed. all the brothers would get together, they'd sit down and say, let's work this out. And that would work, and it'd be binding if they worked it out that way. So now that a shliach's involved, or the apitropos is involved, it's no different. He goes in as a representative of the katan, and he can negotiate. Beit Din is not involved at all. That's what the Ri says, and he's medayik out of Lashon Borin, that they're picking, they're making decisions. Whereas the Rabbeinu Tam says that's not the case, and the Rabbeinu Tam, Freish Dainu Dafka Begoral. The subdivision here is Begoral, V'chit Shrichuto Latil Goralot. What's the big deal to throw lots here to subdivide the property? It's not a big deal. Of course you would do it that way. Begam Tzarich Shumat Beit Din. And you need Beit Din to assess the value of the property to ensure that there is an equitable division and that the Yitomim are having or being represented properly. B'davka b'davar l'shayach be'igud o igud. So only in a cases where there's no what we call call put option, which is that in certain partnerships, when it comes to the dissolution of the partnership, many partnership agreements have a buyout clause in the end, which says that if you want to dissolve the partnership, you can then state a price that you would buy out the whole partnership. Or if the other party doesn't like it, they can choose to buy it out. So if party A says, I want it out of this partnership, and then party B says, well, tell me how much you're going to pay for my half. Party A makes a bid on that other half. Party B can decide either to take the bid, or he can say, I like the price, I'm going to buy you out at that position. The reason is because certain things cannot be subdivided. Certain partnerships, businesses can't be broken in half. And so that's what the Rabbeinu Tam says, that all of this is true when you don't invoke the principle of gold or igud, where it's a call put dissolution clause, then you don't have this, because then you can't throw lots. You can't make decisions like that. But anything that can be subdivided, then you throw lots, and you get the assessment of Beit Din, and that's how you divide it up. And thus what ends? B'shuv hode Ri the Perush Rabbeinu Tam. In the end, the Ri agreed to the position of the Rabbeinu Tam, and that you do have to do this through lots and through the assessment of Beit Din, and not Borin, where they do it on their own, or they act on behalf of the Yitomim, but there is no involvement of a overseeing party, or some sort of arbitrator, in a sense, that Beit Din would be. Mer says, Umiitle the Rav Nachman. Does Rav Nachman really subscribe to this principle, Imkein Makoach Beit Din Yofeh, that we worry about the institutional power and efficacy and standing of the Beit Din, and therefore we want it to be something that's conclusive and not something that can be undermined later? Vatanan, don't we have a Mishnah? Shuma Dayanim. If the Dayanim assess some property, here Rashi knows it's a case where a debtor defaulted on a loan, and he's not willing to pay, and he's not giving up his property. So Beit Din goes down and makes an assessment of his property and sells it, auctions it against his will to pay off the debts that he incurred and he is not paying back. So that's Shuma Dayanim. If they go and assess his property, Shepichtu Shtut or Hotiru Shtut, if they diminish the price by a sixth, or they increase the price by a sixth, Mechran Batel. Mechran batel. Then what they did is batel, and the transaction is unwound. It's nullified. Rabbi Shimon Gamliel Omer, Mechran kayam. That you keep their transaction in place. Because, im kein, makoch Beit Din Yofeh. According to Rabbi Shimon Gamliel, if you do not uphold the assessment of Beit Din, then what's the whole point of having Beit Din assess it? Because you're going to unwind it. You want to protect the integrity of the Beit Din's power. And if you're going to tell me that people are going to question the assessments of a Beit Din, then you're going to undermine the position or authority of the Beit Din in the eyes of the people, and so you can't do that. V'amarav huna berchinina amarav nachman. Halacha k'divrei chachamim. The halacha is like the chachamim. So now you're saying that the halacha is like the chachamim who do not subscribe to this principle. Yet Rav Nachman himself, just before, says the reason that yitonim that go to divide the estates, they can't come back and unwind it, is because of makoach Beit Din Yofeh. So how come in one place he subscribes to that principle, and over here he does not subscribe to that principle? When it says, Lokasha, that's not a problem. Ha, the toe, ha, the low toe. It's a question if they made a mistake or not. In the case of the assessment, they made a mistake. And since they made a mistake, therefore, you don't invoke the principle, Makoach Beit Din Yofeh, because it might be just as detrimental to leave the transaction in place when it's clearly mistaken or wrong. If that's the case, then we allow you to unwind it. In the case of the subdivision of the property between the Yitomim, that's either, we'll call it sour grapes, Or it's someone who has a particular need or interest in this place that we couldn't consider or we didn't consider at the time. But it's not something that undermines the division. The division was done equitably. It was done fairly. So it happens to be that their new ideas or new circumstances have come about. And therefore, maybe they want one wine. There, we're going to invoke the principle of Makoach Beit Din Yofeh. We're not going to undermine Beit Din's actions just for some parochial interests or for somebody's nuances that we couldn't consider originally. Idloto, Gemara says, Mayucholim Limchot. Wait a minute. If they never make a mistake, then what are they objecting to? And this is the answer that we just said before. Because Yucholim Limchot Beruchot. You can say, I wanted the southern side. I like the south-facing feast. I wanted the northern side. I have other fields over there. I want to connect them together. And that these are considerations, but they're not mistakes in the division. These are particular needs of the individual that don't make it inequitable, the division. Simply is a matter of convenience. If I had my druthers, I would rather have this than that. But not that I got anything less because I got the other piece. There, we're going to uphold the din of Beit Din, and we're going to say that it stands despite the complaints of the individual represented. As Tosafot points out over here, depends how big the mistake was. You could have answered that as well. If the mistake is too big, then we say we don't invoke the principle of Makoach Beit Din Yofeh. The other hand, if the mistake is small enough, we will invoke the principle. So you have tensions here between the institution of Beit Din, who which we want to maintain its authority, and we also want to be equitable and we want to make sure that it's assessed properly. So there's that tension there. So what you could have answered, Tosafot says, is that's the difference. When the skew away from the proper price is limited, it's a small amount, then we'd rather uphold the authority of Beit Din than unwind the transaction for that small deviation from their proper price. On the other hand, if the deviation is too big, then we're going to say, listen, it's not equitable anymore, and we're not going to uphold Beit Din's authority in the face of an inequitable solution to the problem, or in the sense that that might in itself undermine the authority of Beit Din, that we're allowing their misassessments to stay in place. And so therefore, that's what Tosafot says you could have answered that way as well. And the Gemara just chose to answer in this way. And then, if you answered in the way that Tosafot suggests, you wouldn't have to worry about this problem of Ruchot, because then it's clear that they were both inequitable, quote-unquote, divisions. If just one is measured enough or limited enough that we'll let it go, the other one is just too big to let it go. And that could have been the answer. Amar Rav Nachman, Achim shechilku, hariyan kelukuchot. Brothers that divide the property, they are like buyers from each other. Now, what this has to do with our Gemara, Rashi says over here, kach dinam shelukuchot katsuv. This is the din of the lukuchot that is set in Perek HaZahav, and others add on, and then the Gemara continues and talks about Beit Din and the mistakes of Beit Din, the size of a mistake of an assessment of Beit Din. So the connection between the two sugyot is that they have the same din in terms of the amount of variance that we will allow in the assessed value. And that's why they're brought over here. Others suggest the reason that with the Achim Shechelku are considered Lukuchot is what generates the difference over here. Had they been Yorshim, then we would be bound to ensure that they got exactly the right amount, and that they got the division was done to the penny, because they're Yorshim, and you have to ensure that each one got his Yerusha. And then once they become Lekuchot, they become buyers, then like buyers or transactions between parties, people know that the prices deviate a little bit, and they're Mochel on those deviations. Whereas if they're Yorshim, you can't be Mochel on the deviation, because Yerusha has a very finite and fixed value where they have to divide it equally. So by saying they're lekuchot, that's what generates this whole idea that you can have a skew or variation off the price and it still be okay. And that's what it says here. Amar Rav Nachman, achim shechul arayin kelukhot. Pachot mishtut, and therefore like any other transaction, if the overcharging or undercharging is less than 1/6, nikna mekach, the transaction goes through. Yeter al shtut, if it's more than 1/6, batel mekach. Then we annul the transaction, it's just too big a skew, and we say transaction doesn't go through. Shtut, if it's exactly a sixth, kana umakzira ona'ah. Then he's koneit, and you return the ona'ah, the overcharging or undercharging that was done. So this is the Gemara in Perek HaZahav and Bobim and Seah, we're going to get there, where ona'ah, the dinim of ona'ah, which is overcharging and undercharging, these are the dinim. If it's less than a sixth, people are mochel, and it goes through, and there's nothing to talk about. If it's more than a sixth, it's too big a variation. People are not mochel. The transaction gets unwound. Add a sixth, you're on that borderline. So over there, the transaction stays in place. You just have to return the overcharging or the undercharging. The money has to be returned. So what the Gemara says is the same thing applies to brothers subdividing the estate. Since they are purchasers from each other, the variation is subject to the same rules as buyers in a marketplace. So Mar says, Amarava, Adamram Pachot Mishtut Nikne Mekach. That would we say that less than a sixth the transaction goes through. Lo Amram Elo Shab Yishliach. That's only in the case where he didn't appoint an agent to act on his behalf. But Shab Yishliach, if they appointed agents to act on their behalf, Amar Litzkuni Shudartich Velo Leivute. This is the principle we said before. I sent you to do something good for me. I didn't send you to do something bad for me. Now again, here, good and bad is that they were not necessarily empowered to do something good or do something bad. They were empowered to work out the negotiation and subdivide the property. But now, you can't do it at the expense of the principal that sent you. If you go and make a mistake in your assessment, then you misrepresented him. You did not act faithfully for the principal that sent you. And therefore, there was a termination or an automatic termination of the agency here because you didn't act as an agent. You acted maybe for your own purposes or your own interests. You're certainly not acting on the best interests of the party who sent you. And so that's what Rava says over here. It's one thing if the person themselves is doing this, that's fine. But if they someone to act on their behalf and such a variation takes place, then we'll unwind it because he'll say the whole agency was abrogated, and it's annulled now because I didn't send you to do something that is going to hurt me and it's going to be to my detriment. Some people suggest the reason is because when the principal is the party, then he can be mochel on the shtut. He can just say, you know what, it's fine, these are variations, these are standard variations, I'm okay. Or maybe we even say there's an implicit mechila. The problem is when he sends the shliach's not empowered to give that forgiveness. It's not a power to say, don't worry about that. Now, that comes up all the time when you're talking about a cashier in a store. And a cashier in the store, when there's some sort of variation in the price or in the change, then the cashier says, you know what, keep the change. Do they have a right to say, keep the change? They're acting on behalf of the Baal HaBayit. Did the Baal HaBayit really empower them to do something that's to his detriment? Do they have the power of mechila? The answer probably is yes. Because he wants the cashier to act in a way that will engender goodwill with the customers. And therefore, maybe he allows for a certain amount of, quote unquote, forgiveness or letting things go in order to build that goodwill. So in likelihood that when the cashier says, you know, keep the change, as long as it's mistaber, meaning that's something that's reasonable, then you can say, fine, that the cashier may be empowered. Once it gets to be to larger amounts, obviously you have to really question whether the Baal HaBayit gave them that power or did they have that power. So the same thing over here. The shliach is not empowered to do such a thing. Since it's not empowered to do such a thing, then we unwind the transaction. Even though if the principal was here, we wouldn't unwind the transaction. V'hadamran, and that which you said, or hadamart, yeter mishtut batel mekach, when it's more than one-sixth, the transaction's annulled. V'hadamran al-dlo amar nifligin b'shuma de beidina. That's only if they didn't say we're going to divide this based on the arbitration of a Beit Din. But my niflog b'shuma the Beit Dina, if they say let us divide it up based on the assessment or what would have been a assessment of Beit Din, michran kayam, then the transaction goes through. It's not shuma dayanim shepichdu shtut or itiru shtut michran batal. That's the Chachamim Shita, Rav Shmuel Amir, michran kayam. This is the same right that we just quoted, the same mission that we just quoted from before. The way Rashi explains it over here is, we just saw we had a machlok between the Chachamim and Rabbi Shimon ben Gamliel. Chachamim say that if Beit Din makes a mistake more than a shtut, we annul the transaction. Rabbi Shimon Gamliel says, Makoch Beit Din Yofe. Then what is the story with Beit Din's power there? We don't want to allow you to do that. So what Rashi claims over here is, that what Rav Nachman says here is, that which we said before, that Yeter Shtut is Batel, that's as long as you didn't invoke a Shumat Beit Din. You didn't ask for an arbitrating assessment of value by a Beit Din. But once you get that valuation by Beit Din, then you're bound by that valuation, irrespective of the fact that it is varying significantly from what the real price is. Or in essence, what Rashi says in here, the Kaimalunk Rabbi Shimon Gamliel, Damar Mechran Kayam. He is paskening like Rabbi Shimon Gamliel that when Beit Din makes a mistake, it stands because we don't want to undermine the authority of Beit Din. Now, wait a minute. That's what the Rashi says over here. Wait a minute. Wasn't Rav Nachman the one who said before that halacha kedivrei chachamim? So if Rav Nachman said halacha kedivrei chachamim, why is Rav saying halacha kedivrei Rabbi Shimon Gamliel? Okay, not a big deal. You have two Amoraim. It is a big deal because Rav is Rav Nachman's Talmud. He says his Rebbe is Rav Nachman. Rav Nachman says halacha chachamim. Rav says halacha Rabbi Shimon Gamliel. So we have Rashi says. That's exactly what Rav is saying. I don't hold by my Rebbe's position. Rav Nachman says that. I say this. And that's the difference in our opinion. This question that Rashi raises will lead Tosfot to come to the exact opposite conclusion. So we'll see that in a second. But there, now we're reading the Gemara based on the Girsa of Rashi. And that was who said when the Achim come to subdivide the property, if they make a mistake or variance of 1/6, the transaction stands and you return the excess. Lo amran el de metaltalim. That's only true by metaltalim, non-real property, movable objects. Aval mekarke, ain onah le karkot. But when it comes to land, there's no such thing as onah by karkot, because by land, it is basically beauty in the eye of the beholder. And, or location, 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 meaning that certain people will pay more for the same piece of land. This is a very personal thing with regards to land, and therefore there's no ona'ah by karka'ot. So if there's no ona'ah by karka'ot, then none of the rules will apply, because even if they're transacting, if it was a normal transaction, we wouldn't unwind the transaction for this reason. Now, Tosafot over here speaks about their position in other places in Shas, as opposed to Rashi. When Rashi says, ain ona'ah by karka'ot, it means period. There is no such thing as ona'ah by karkot. There's nothing to discuss. You can charge as much as you want, or you can pay as little as you want, as long as both parties agree, that is the transaction price. Another Tosafot, based on Yerushalmi, says that there's a cap. When we say ona'ah by karkot, it means it's not subject to the regular rules of ona'ah, which are the sixth. Because by the parshiyah in the Torah that speaks about it, it says, the okonami yad. It's talking about vessels or utensils when it's being there. It's something that can be passed from hand to hand. Therefore, the dinim of onah are limited to metaltalim. On the other hand, when we say ain onah lekarkot, it doesn't mean there's no onah whatsoever. It just means that you're not subject to 1/6, but at 50%. You're allowed to have a skew of up to 50% or a variance of up to 50% in the value. That would be considered okay. If you go beyond that, even by karka, that's just too much. It's reasonable to assume that people have differences in views with regards to a property of up to 50%. But beyond that, that's onah. That's what Tosafot does over here. He also limits it. And even by karka, we say there's no such thing as ona'ah. That is when you based it on value. You assessed values and then you divided it. But if the division was done by mishkata, by measurement, by your ruler, lo, that doesn't work. Because Rabba says, Damarabba called the Varsha midah mishkalu minyan. Anything that is sold or transacted in based on its measurement, its weight, or its number, afilu pachot mikdeona nami chozer. There, it's clear that even if you had a variance of less than a sixth, you would have to unwind the transaction because, by definition, if you're giving an exactitude to the measurement, then you are expecting the right answer. You're expecting a result that accords with the measurements or is exact to the measurements. You don't have somebody measure out the field particularly and then give you the wrong amount. That doesn't make sense. Or yet, I'm buying 12 of an item and they give you 14 of the item or you get 8 of the item. It's clearly not the case. You expected to get 12 and therefore, even if it's less than a shtut, less than 1/6, that would not be considered to be a reason to say that the transaction goes through and there's no onah. There is onah. That's the way that Rashi reads this Gemara. Rova, in every section here, takes his Rebbe Rav Nachman's position about the fact that brothers that divide are considered to be buyers, and therefore they're subject to the regular rules of ona'ah. Less than a sixth, it's kayam, nothing to do. More than a sixth, it's batel. A sixth, it stands that you have to return the excess. All those statements that are true by any transaction are also true by achim. Rava qualifies each one of those statements and says, that's not true in every case. In a case where it's pachot mishtut, less than a sixth, We would still unwind the transaction when there was a shliach involved. There was an agent involved because they don't have a right to do that. In the case of shtut, where it's exactly a sixth, and you kamichlam kayam and you return the money, that's only true by mitaltalin. But in the case of karkot, we wouldn't say that. In the case of more than a shtut, that's only if Beit Din is not involved. But if Beit Din's involved, it will stand no matter what. So those are Rova's qualifications according to Rashi. Tosafot does not like Rashi's pshat for the exact reason that Rashi questioned himself, which is, didn't Rav Nachman say the halacha is like the Chachamim, and now you're saying Rova says it's halacha Rav Shimon Gamliel. Rashi says, yep, that's right. He doesn't hold like Rav Nachman. Tosafot says, dochuk ma'od, to say that Rova would not hold like by his Rebbe Mufak Rav Nachman. How could he argue he's going to argue on his Rebbe like that? Doesn't make so much sense. That's number one. Number two question he has is, the fact that Gabe shtut, it says, ain't ona ala karkot. Mashma de beyeter shtut, yesh lehen ona. The fact that Rashi sets up this qualification of rova by karkot, by metalkalim, and says it's not true by karkot, he sets it up in the section of the ona, which says that if it's a sixth, you let the transaction stand and you return the excess. The implications from that are that even by karkot, if it was more than a sixth, you would have to return it. Because they only qualify it in the case of exactly a sixth. They don't bring that qualification by more than a sixth. So Tosfot says that's not right. Because even in karkaot, even if it's more than a sixth, it's still not batel ha-mekka. At least up to 50%, it's not batel ha-mekka. For that reason, Tosfot says the name of Rebbeinu Tam, lekach nir Rebbeinu Tam, the goros ipcha. The girsa is the opposite. And he says that's the girsa of Rebbeinu Hananel. And most likely it was the Gish in the Gemara before Rashi came along and changed it. You can see in Rashi, Hachi Garcina. In the last wide line in Rashi over there, it says Hachi Garcina. Rashi changed the Girsa in the Gemara to what we have it. The reason our Gemara reads like Rashi is because in general, when Rashi made redactions in the Girsa, they were accepted in the printed versions, and now we have what Rashi has. We're not looking at what Rashi was looking at. But here the Baalei Tosafot are saying that they, Rabbeinu Tam thinks otherwise, and Rabbeinu Hananel thinks otherwise, and in most likelihood, they had the girsa before Rashi changed it, which is, that you say when it's overcharging, undercharging by a sixth, the transaction stands and you return the excess. That's as long as you didn't involve a Beit Din. But if you involve the Beit Din in there, then the transaction stays in place because of Mikoach Beit Din Yofet. And that's which we say, Yeter Ashtut is Batel. That's only true by metalkalin. By karkot, even yeter mishtut, it is not batel. So in that way, Tosafot deals with both of those issues. First of all, Rova is no longer arguing on Rav Nachman, because he only invokes the principle of Eim Kein Makoach Beit Din Yofeh up to a sixth. Beyond a sixth, he'll agree with his Rebbe Rav Nachman and say the Locha is like the Chachamim, which is, when it's more than a sixth, you're right. We don't invoke the principle of Eim Kein Makoach Beit Din Yofeh. As well as the fact that he will now be saying that by karkaot, there's no ana even when you go above the threshold of a sixth, and therefore you're not worried about this idea of ein ona ba karkaot being limited to a sixth. So Tosafot flips the girsa, or probably goes back to the original girsa, in order to accommodate both of those issues. One of which is, how could Rava be arguing his Rebbe? Now Rava's not arguing on his Rebbe. And number two is, karkaot don't have ona even above a sixth. But it's not. That Mishnah that's found in Baba Kama, someone who sends a fire, a torch, in the hand of a cherishot v'katan, patur min dinei adam v'chayav v'dinei shamayim. He's not responsible. Courts can't take him to task and force him to pay. But v'dinei shamayim, it's clear that he caused the problem. These, quote-unquote, irresponsible parties took the fire and caused damage with the fire. Whose fault is that? Well, it's, of course, the person or these individuals' fault. But they, in a sense, don't have the capacity to really make good decisions. The fact that someone put it into their hands, that was the bad decision. And so we can't hold them for that bad decision culpable b'dinei adam, because it's only groma or garmi. On the other hand, b'dinei shamayim, they're going to hold them responsible, because it's clear he precipitated the problem by giving it to these irresponsible parties. Shilach b'yad b'keach, on the other hand, if he sends it with an agent who is responsible, Bikeach chayav. The responsible party is chayav if something happens with the fire. V'amai. Why don't we invoke the principle, ne'ayimash lucho shaladam kimoto? You just taught me with all these different sources that an agent of a person acts on their behalf. Why don't we say the same thing over here? That the agent carrying the fire is doing it on behalf of the principal. If damage happens, then it's the principal's problem or the principal's responsibility. I says, shiny hotam, it's different over there. Dein shliach, the dvar aveira. There is no such thing as agency when it comes to doing something bad or doing an aveira. It's a very important principle. Damrinan, how do you know or why is that the case? Divrei arav, v'divrei atamid, divrei mishomim. When you are given the choice between listening to the Rebbe or listening to the student, who should you listen to? It's clear you should listen to the Rebbe. So in that case, who's the Rebbe here? Kadosh Baruch Hu. Kadosh Baruch Hu says, don't do this bad deed. Don't do this item. The principal who's sending the agent says, go ahead and do it. He's the Talmid. Who are you going to listen to, Hashem or the Talmid? That principal therefore severs their agency relationship and makes it the responsibility of the agent. Whatever he does, he will be held culpable on his own for it because he shouldn't have listened to the individual who instructed him to do otherwise. Or in essence, what God says to him is, I was just, the person claiming, the agent claims, I was just listening to him. And God will say to him, well, if he told you to jump off a bridge, would you jump off a bridge? The answer is no. So do over here. I told you don't do this. If I told you don't do this, you're not going to be listening to him. And that's not an excuse for you to be patur or to assign the culpability back to the principal. You as the agent are now responsible on your own for the behavior or the action that you took. Your point is well taken. It happens to be what you're saying is just the opposite, which is that it has to be here that it's b'mezid. It has to be here that it's done with intent and knowledge. Because otherwise, how can you invoke the principle of divrei arav, divrei atamid, divrei mishomim? That's a logical argument that says that the person doing the aveira is aware of the fact that he's doing an aveira and he's making the wrong choice. He's listening to the person who sent them rather than a kodesh baruch hu. So if he's a shogeg, if he makes a mistake and he has poor judgment here and he doesn't realize that he's doing something wrong, or he's mistaken in his assumption that the person sending him is telling him to do the right thing and he doesn't need to listen to God, there he clearly can't be held culpable for that because you can't invoke the principle of divrei arav, divrei atamid, divrei mishomim, because he doesn't know what the divrei arav is and what is the divrei atamid, whether it's because he's a shogeg, whether it's because he just doesn't know, he's not discerning enough to know the difference, then you can't make him culpable. So in that instance, it's possible that you could argue that there is shliach l'dvar aveira because there's no way to pawn off the culpability on the shliach. And therefore, maybe the principal will be obligated in that case. There are those that want to argue that we would not make such a distinction. And we would say, even in the case of Shogeg, they still apply the principle of Divrei Arav, Divrei Atamid, Divrei Mishomim, not because that's the thought process over here, but because that principle exists, therefore we establish the fact that Ein Shliach L'Dvar Aveira. Ein Shliach L'Dvar Aveira then becomes the given. And once you have that given, it doesn't matter if you do it with Mezid or B'Shogeg, there's Ein Shliach L'Dvar Aveira. Meaning that the logic here dictates what should be. Once we've established what should be, it doesn't matter if it's done b'shogeg or b'mezid, there is no such thing as shliach l'dvar aveira. The second thing that's interesting to note over here, which is what you're noting, which is that they're calling it an aveira here when he lights the field on fire. That is an interesting discussion. We'll get there when we get to Baba Kama and our introduction to Baba Kama. But that's a question about nizakim in general. When it comes to damages, is damaging someone's property an aveira? Or simply, you are responsible for your actions. So that means if you damage someone else's property, you never necessarily violate the law in the Torah, but you are responsible. And you have to make reparations for whatever damage that you did. So, of course, we're not going to say to you that people can go around damaging property as long as they paid for it. That's obviously not the mindset that we have. But there may be no aveira in doing nezek. If you do nezek, then you just are responsible for the nezek that you do. Over here, seemingly, it's classifying it as an aveira. By classifying it as an aveira, it's telling you not only is there a reparations issue when you do damage to someone else, there's also an iser involved, that there is something where the Torah says, don't do nezek. And that's, again, we'll discuss that when we get to Baba Kama, in the introduction to Baba Kama, whether there is such a concept, or what is the iser of doing nezek to another person's property. The way Rashi terms it, choshuv shliach levar shidchev shlocho, ela harehu kosem elav. The whole agency is abrogated, and it's as if you're acting on your own volition in that case. That's basically what Ein Shliach L'Dvar Aveira means. It's now you are responsible for your actions, and you'll be held accountable for your actions. Now the Gemara says, Vada Tanya, what are you going to do with this in Breita in Ila? This is always a question that's brought up with regards to the Me'ilah, because Me'ilah is the exception to the rule, which is what the Gemara will come to. But the Gemara is asking from Hadatan or Mishnah and Me'ilah, Shliach Shlo Asa Shlichuto. An agent who did not carry out his agency, Shliach Ma'al. Then the Shliach is Ma'al. Me'ilah is when you misappropriate something from Hekdesh. So in a case where the Balabait told the Shliach, take this meat and give it to the guests. The meat was meat of Hekdesh. And so he wasn't supposed to give it to the guests. And therefore he misappropriated Hekdesh. So here when the Shliach did this, if the Shliach acts appropriately, meaning he carried out exactly the instructions of the Balabait, then the Balabait is Ma'al. He's the one responsible for the Me'ilah. But then if the Shliach deviates from his agency, he becomes responsible for the Me'ilah because he didn't carry out the instructions. He acted on his own now because he didn't do what the agency asked him to do. So that's why Shliach Shlo Asa Shlichuto, if he doesn't do the agency that he was asked by the principal to do, Shliach Ma'al. He now becomes responsible, and if there's Me'ilah, he'll be responsible for the Me'ilah. Asa Shlichuto, then if he does or carries out his agency exactly, Balabait Ma'al. The Balabait is Mo'el. Ki Asa Shlichuto, the Balabait. Balabait Mi'il Ma'al. You see over here, when he does do the agency of the owner is held responsible for the Me'ilah. Amai. Neima ain't shliach ledvar aveira. Why don't we say here, this is an aveira, and say ain't shliach ledvar aveira. So why should the balabait be held responsible for the actions of the shliach? Why does this work over here? Shiny me'ilah, de'alfa chait chait mitruma. Me'ilah is different because we learn out me'ilah from truma. There is a gzeir shava. Gzeir shava is used in many items, not just in this. But there are many limudim back and forth between truma and mi'ilah from the chait, which is v'chata bishkaga mikodshe Hashem, mi'ilah, and b'truma it says lo yisu alav chait. So in both those cases, we have the word chait used. The Gzeir Shava teaches us, just like by truma, there is shlichut, because it says gamatem. So too by mi'ilah, there is shlichut, despite the fact that it is an aveira. Ma'chuma mishavet shliach, just like truma, you can make it a shliach because gamatem. Af mi'ilah mishavet shliach. And so too, by mi'ilah, you can have a shliach. B'neilef mina. So then why doesn't that become the paradigm to say that there is shliach l'dvar aveira? Now you see that there is shliach l'dvar aveira. Why do we assume ain't shliach l'dvar aveira? Mishom davi mi'ilah u'shlichut yad shnei k'tuvim abayim k'echad. Because mi'ilah and shlichut yad are two psukim telling you the same thing. We have two psukim telling you the same thing. They no longer are a paradigm. They are the exception to the rule. All right, in 1 second we'll explain what those are. There are two questions with regards to Me'ilah. The first of which we already addressed, but I'm making you aware of it, is that Me'ilah is only true when you're shogeg. There's no such thing as Me'ilah when you do it b'mezid. If you do it intentionally, you're not chayav in Me'ilah. It's an isur, but you're not chayav in Me'ilah for the korban and for the chomesh. It's only when you do it b'shogeg. But that's problematic, because how do you invoke the principle of Divrei Arav, Divrei HaTalmid, Divrei Meishomim, if we're dealing with the case of Shogeg? So that the Bali HaTosafot raised this issue, and say, Teima, HaKorchach, Mayri B'Shogeg? If you're dealing with Me'ilah B'Shogeg, how could that be the case? Va'omeri, Da'achi Mayri Afilu K'shenizkar Shliach Kamar D'mal Balabait. The Ri says over here that even if the Shliach realizes that it's Hekdesh, the Balabait is in trouble, or is Moel over here. Batam, the fish me'ilah ain't elav shogeg. The fikach, mal oto shalonizkar. Therefore, we assign the culpability to the one who doesn't remember. As long as someone is not remembering or being b'shogeg, we're going to assign the culpability to that one who is b'shogeg. Ba'oshet in nizkar meizidu. Yikom akom dafka im nizkru shnehem. Aval im nizkar shleach davad balabait ma'al. So that's only when both of them remember or know that it is b'mezid, then we invoke the principle of ein shliach l'dvar aveira. But if only one of them remembers, one's a shogeg, the one who's a shogeg will be left holding the cup. Tosafot in the end accepts this distinction between mezid and shogeg and says ein ochanavi b'shogeg, there is no ein shliach l'dvar aveira because you can't invoke the principle of divrei rav, divrei talmid, divrei mi shomim, and therefore you can't invoke the principle of ein shliach l'dvar aveira. And therefore, he says that the case has to be a case here where it's b'mezid. So he comes up with a hefty timsa that the shliach's b'mezid, the balabait's b'shogeg, and that carries the responsibility back to the balabait. Other rishonim, as we explained before, say that once we've established the principle of ein shliach l'dvar aveira by mezid, it carries over to Shogeg, even though you can't invoke the principle of Divrei Rav, Divrei Talmid, Divrei Mi, Shomin. The second thing to note here about the Me'ila case is, what is the default status? Why would we assume that Ein Shliach L'Dvar Aveira? I mean that the Gemara over here says, questions about Me'ila, why is this true? Ein Shliach L'Dvar Aveira. What do you mean Ein Shliach L'Dvar Aveira? We've proven all along that Shlichud works. So your underlying assumption should be that Shlichud works. Shouldn't that be the default status? And then if that's the case, why is the Gemara challenging and saying Ein Shliach L'Dvar Aveira? We should say what? Shlichud works, and it's not a surprise that it works over here. And Ein Shliach L'Dvar Aveira is the exception to the rule. Or do we say that by definition, Shlichud Bar Aveira is very questionable? Because all the examples that we brought so far, the Shlichud was involved with a Shliach Mitzvah. All of them were mitzvot that we discussed, and we only involve Shlichud agency in cases of mitzvot. So maybe we should say that it doesn't apply by an Aveira. And if that's the case, that's the nature of the Gemara's question, which is, the default should be Ein Shliach L'Dvar Aveira. So why is Me'ila the exception? So the part of embedded in this question is, what is the underlying assumption, or what is the default status? If you believe that the default is that only by mitzvot Shlichud applies, then it makes sense to question Me'ila and say Ein Shliach L'Dvar Aveira. But if that's the case, why do you need the principle of Divrei Rav, Divrei Talmid, Divrei Mi Shomim? Because Shlichud agency should not apply even without that principle, because it's all the examples that we brought so far, all the sources are by mitzvot, not by Aveirot. So that causes you a problem. Why do you need Divrei Rav, Divrei Talmid? On the other hand, if you say that the default status is that there is Shliach L'Dvar Aveira, because our Shlichud works everywhere, then what's the nature of the Gemara's question over here of Ein Shliach L'Dvar Aveira? Why are you applying the principle over here of Ein Shliach L'Dvar Aveira? The more natural way would be to assume that there is Shliach L'Dvar Aveira. And so then why is the Gemara challenging Me'ila? So that's why the question here is somewhat difficult, because you have to make an assumption about what you think should be the default status of Aveira, and each position leaves you with a small difficulty. If you assume that in general Ein Shliach L'Dvar Aveira, because all the examples or all the sources are by mitzvot, then what do I need Divrei Rav, Divrei Talmid? That would have been the natural view. And then why do I need a special principle over here? Some Rishonim suggest that you need both principles because we're talking about two different parties. One is whether the Mishaleach, the principle, is culpable. And that's the question of Shliach L'Dvar Aveira or Ein Shliach L'Dvar Aveira. The second question that we have is the Shliach himself, what is his responsibility or culpability over here? And the two might be independent. It might be the fact that this agent is chayav, because Divrei Rav, Divrei Talmid, Divrei Mishomim, and yet this principle is also chayav because he sent him to do it. And so therefore you might need both principles, or there actually might be two issues that are being discussed here, which is the culpability of the Mishaleach and the culpability of the Shliach. And many Rishonim believe that even if we are mechayiv the Mishaleach, the Shaliach, the agent himself, still will be held culpable. If you say that the default status is that there is a Shliach L'Dvar Aveira, then what's the nature of the Gemara's question here when they're challenging Me'ila? Just to note that is something to take into consideration. Now the Gemara says, so now you told me that there are two sources. Me'ila ha'damran. Me'ila, we just brought the case where there's Shliach L'Dvar Aveira. Shlichud Yad, Mahi. The Shlichud Yad that he says, the second pasuk, what is that? The Tanya, Akol Davar Pesha. This is talking about a shomer who is not allowed to be sholeach yad. He's not allowed to take or utilize the pikadon, the deposit that is left with him. If he does use it, he becomes responsible for it. So it says, "Akol davar pesha b'shomer mehem lechayav ala machshava kemaseh." That even if you think about using it, you become responsible for the item, even if you never carried it out and you didn't use it. Shlichud yad can't be generated even without actually doing the shlichud yad. Over here, the Gemara says Makshova. In other places in Chas, Tosafot notes that Makshova really means Bedibor. And if you articulate that you're going to use this item or you're going to take this item, in the end you relent and you don't do it, Beit Shammai says you're responsible for the item because you were Sholeach Yad. You only become responsible for the item if you actually take it and utilize it, meaning that you are absconding with the object, and then you become responsible. Shinemar, if he was not Shaleach his Yad, so Beit Hillel says that sounds like the only way you're culpable is if you actually are Shaleach Yad. But what they're both saying is that once you are Shaleach Yad, you become the responsible party. If you stole it now, and now you're the responsible party for the item. Amru Beit Shammai the Beit Hillel, v'lo ne'amar kol davar pesha. Even if they do a pesha, pesha means that you are thinking of doing something wrong, that should be enough. It says explicitly, if he didn't actually take it. Sounded like it, the only way to be culpable was if you did take it. So then Beit Shammai says back to him, okay, I hear what you're saying, but then what are you going to do with that kol davar pesha? You have two psukim, one seems to indicate that it's, even if you have evil thoughts, even if you're just considering it, it's enough. The other one says that until you actually do it, you're not held culpable because you take a shbuah that you didn't take it, implying that if you did take it, you would be responsible. So he says, I would think only the shomer himself is responsible. Amar the Abdul Shlucho, if he says to his Eved or to an agent of his, go take that object, Minayin, how do we know that he will be held culpable as if he's Sholeach Yad? Tamalomar kol davar pesha. That even on any dibur that you say, davar pesha, the dibur of pesha is enough. So Beit Shammai says the dibur pesha as you're articulating your intent to take it. Beit Hillel says dibur pesha, davar pesha, or dibur pesha as being your instructions to someone else to take it. That you can be sholeach yad through a proxy, through an agent. So that's a shliach lidvar aveira. Where it says anicha the Beit Hillel, that works well for Beit Hillel, who says that this is a case of shliach lidvar aveira. According to Beit Shammai, where that pasuk is used to teach you that even if you articulate shlichut yad you're chayav, they don't have the pasuk to teach you that agency also makes you chayav. So Beit Hillel, the mukmin leilai krav makshava kemaset, to teach you that your thoughts are as good as your actions, Nelef minay. Learn from the pasuk by Me'ila that there is such thing as shliach lidvar aveira. Shum tava Me'ila, tvicha u'mechira, shnei k'tuvim abayim ke'echad. Because Me'ila, which we already learned, and tvicha and mechira are two k'tuvim teaching the same thing. Tvicha mechira is someone who steals an animal, and then after stealing it, either shechs it or sells it. There they're chayav arba v'chamesh. They're chayav four or five times. That obligation of mitvicha mechira, the Mishnah Gemara says, the choshnei k'tuvim abayim kechad eim melamdim. Two psukim teaching the same thing. They are the exception, not the paradigm. Mila hadamran, again, Mila, we already told you what the case is. Tvicha mechira mayi. What's the case of tvicha mechira where we have shliach the dvar aveira? Amakra, utivacho o mecharo. Says that he shechted it or sold it. Ma mechira yedei acher. By definition, selling involves another party. You can't sell it to someone unless there is a someone on the other side of the transaction. So by definition, mechira is done through another party. Af tvicha ayidei acher. So too, the shechting can be done by someone else. What does that show you? That even if the shechita is not done by you, but by your proxy or your agent, you will be held culpable as if you stole it and shechted it, and you'll be chayav arba v'chamisha, as if you shechted it. So you see from here, shliach lidvar aveira. So for Beit Shammai as well, I have two psukim teaching you the same thing, which is shliach shliach lidvar aveira. But if I have two psukim teaching you the same thing, then it's those are the exception to the rule, not the paradigm. And from that we learn, in general, ein shliach lidvar aveira. Okay, we're going to stop here. Six lines down on the top of Mem Gimel Amud Aleph.